Duck South Studios in Oxford, Mississippi.
We're mass communicating.
It's a bold strategy, Cotton. Let's see if it pays off for them.
This is the End of the Line podcast, powered by DuckSouth.com.
I gave it a 10.
Sweep the leg. You have a problem with that.
And now, here are your hosts, Rocky LaFleur.
Everybody on? Good.
Great. Grand. Wonderful.
No yelling on the bus.
Josh Webb.
Sorry I had a fight in the middle of your black pants party.
And Jake Latondras.
I am bad news.
Also starring Rob Kroon.
I bet this guy's into the woods $100.
And Bradley Ramsey.
No, Mark, didn't say it.
Showtime.
All right, here we go. Hold your ears, folks. It's showtime.
Showtime, everybody! Showtime!
Welcome to the End of the Line podcast. I'm Rocky LaFleur in the Duck South Studios on this Wednesday morning. Joining me on the other end of the line, Mr. Bill Cooksey. Bill, conference
calls
all morning.
What's that?
Your life is built around conference calls.
It seems that way. And it, in my past life, once a month was a lot of conference calls. And now I have five or six a week and in a slow week. But that's, you know, you're working with a lot of people from a lot of different parts of the country, and you somehow have to get together and talk about what's going on. And I mean, we get so spread out on this conservation thing. You know, right now, 2 days ago, I was pushing my people in Louisiana to contact their representatives on this public lands package, which passed yesterday. So we were excited about that. But at the same time, we're getting ready to push people all over the country, sportsmen, on the Clean Water Act, which is about to be rolled back, and that's going to hurt our ducks and our fishing. So, yeah, there's a lot of good stuff happening in Washington, D.C. With the administration. But, you know, they're going to do some things we're not happy with at the same time. So we just have to be vigilant and keep folks informed. But, it takes talking to a lot of different people to stay on top of this stuff.
All right, the Clean Water Act. Just a few seconds or minutes on that. Explain what's happening with that real quick.
Well, the deal is Clean Water Act is actually a Republican, originally was a Republican thing. Richard Nixon, if I'm not mistaken, I'm not a policy guy, but my understanding it was a Nixon administration deal. And it came about in early 70s, late 60s, early 70s. I mean, you know, we had rivers catching on fire. This country was in a mess as far as water because we had done things for hundreds of years without really understanding the ramifications. So that started the process to cleaning up our lakes, our rivers, our streams. And the more we learn about how water works on our continent, and I guess really all continents, it's all more connected than anyone realizes. I mean, a prairie pothole in North Dakota will impact how that pothole is dealt with, whether it's tiled and drained or whether it's left intact, whether it's, you know, all the cover around it is burned every fall when it dries out. How it's treated will impact potentially Devil's Lake or another river down from, I mean, that water makes it all the way down eventually, somehow. There are prairie potholes, believe it or not, in Texas. And 40% of some of these potholes' water actually ends up in the Gulf from north central Texas. So the Clean Water Act, as it's grown, because we learn more over the years and different administrations strengthen it to give more protections to, you know, the streams and the potholes and the things that really, for we sportsmen, make all the difference in the world. The proposal that they have right now will be the biggest rollback in protections in history. And, of course, we're going back to the 70s. And it means that roughly half of the remaining wetlands in the lower 48 and up to half of stream miles would lose pollution protections permanently. And think about that. Roughly half of the streams and half of the remaining wetlands, just because of how they're designated. And when you change the wording, those potholes, those streams that run rampant. I have one in my backyard. I mean, this sucker has been a river most of the winter. But this summer, it could go dry except for a few little pools. But that's a pretty important creek. And it's pretty obvious it's an important creek, and it's draining, you know, right over our aquifer we drink out of in Memphis. So to remove the protections from so many of these in just one fell swoop, it's an enormous mistake, and our fish and waterfowl will pay heavily for it.
Why? Why, though? Why? Who's pushing to roll them back? Where's that money coming from? It's money somewhere.
Business? Come on, man, business. And I am a conservative guy. I am pro-business. But Some folks don't really get it. Let's face it, a lot of folks don't get it. If you're a sportsman and you keep up with what's happening in our wildlife resources, you know a lot of people don't get it, just like they don't get that an AR-15, I was on a conference call the other day with people from a lot of different groups, and the subject of deer hunting came up because of something I was working on. And, you know, they said, you know, and they tried to say AR-15s are good deer rifles. I said, they really are. Awesome for kids and women. What do you mean? Won't it tear up all the meat? And a lot of people pushing for this Clean Water Act change are as clueless about how our water and wildlife resources really work and are connected. And that's leaving the human element out. I mean, let's face it, none of us want to drink the crap that has been in our streams in the past. A lot of these people are as clueless about water and wildlife as those folks who thought an AR-15 was fully automatic and huge bullets that would tear up a deer if you shot it. That's just the way it is. So it's up to us as sportsmen who do get it to educate them, just as we try to with firearms, to say, look, man, it's a semi-automatic rifle. This little bitty bullet. Like, I don't know if you've ever seen, I do it on Facebook every now and again. I'll line up a 223, a 270, a 375 H&H, and a 12-gauge duck load. Say, so which one you want to get shot with? If you just had to pick one, well, I'm taking the little bitty bullet. Yeah, that's the one that comes out of the AR-15, guys. And it's the same thing with water and with our wildlife. People who don't get it just see, man, this is a creek that dries up half of the year. This is a pothole that every other year is dry. Yeah, some springs, it has some ducks on it, but then it dries up in the summer. What use is that? What use is that? We could build something there. We can farm there. You know, a lot of these pollution protections aren't necessarily from dumping chemicals. Obviously, that's a big deal, but it's where you can build, how you can build, what you can do there that might put that stream in harm's way.
See, that's all the way down to say. I was thinking about farming, you know, converting more of the prairie pothole region into farming, or pulling
absolutely
those protections away from government programs to build or you know, convert it back into row crop.
Yeah, a farmer technically can do whatever he wants as far as a pothole. If he wants to drain it and farm it, he can. Problem is, he won't get support on that property with all the federal programs he's in. That's the way it's been for a while. You know that better than I do. I've probably flubbed it a little bit, but they're wanting to remove that, you know, where no problem, we'll pay their crop insurance. As an American taxpayer, I don't want to pay when that crop fails on a place that should have ducks breeding on it. Shouldn't have been plowed in the first place. And we know there are a lot of places in our part of the Mississippi River Valley that should have never been cleared and put to the plow. And that could definitely be said for the prairie pothole region. So we're going to push back against it, man.
it seems to me, and I'll end it with this, it seems to me that away from, say, a pothole, just a dumb person question when it concerns breeding, but how far out from the water's edge will a duck go to lay its eggs?
That's kind of a loaded question, and I'm not to get down into how many feet, how many yards, that sort of thing. I'm sure not the guy to do that. But, you know, species like pintails, they use the pothole, but then they nest, as you said, way out in the stubble. And that historically is what they did. They nested out in that short grass in that prairie, but within walking distance of the water. Pretty good walk, potentially, but within walking distance. So now that if that's row crop, that's no longer a pintail production area. So much depends on available cover for most species. As far as puddle ducks that will nest on dry ground versus some of the divers that want to nest more over water. So much has to do with how much cover is around a pothole. You know, they're going to make use of what's available and what the best what their best option is.
You know, I remember in the, I guess it was the late 90s, when Clinton was still in office. Clinton put out a program, this concerning potholes of today, but he paid a pile of money to landowners, not so much farmers, but landowners that surrounded these waterways that you're talking about, to put them in a CRP type program. Now, that was for the runoff going back into that water, but almost clean it up.
Filter strips.
But, yeah.
Yeah.
And it was great.
You know,
sometimes we jump on liberals about their programs, but man, that was a great one.
Yeah, I mean, look, I tell people all the time, and I had, long before I was doing this, we're all in a special interest group. I hear people gripe about special interest groups. Here's a newsflash. You are in one. Whoever you are, whatever you do, whatever you care about, that's a special interest group, and you have people lobbying on your behalf in Washington, D.C., whether you know it or not. So some of us do it for ducks and fish and wildlife and hunting and fishing. And if it's a good program, I don't care who the president is, and he deserves a lot of credit. We can't always afford them. You know, that's the long and short of it. And I get that. We all get that. And that's one of the great things about my organization. We have such a huge, you know, staff of great scientists, and they really look at this stuff and they pick out the important stuff as far as projects, as far as programs, and say, look, this is big. This one, you know, it'd be nice in a perfect world, but, you know, when you have to make a this or that, this is the one. And that gives me a lot of confidence when I talk to people about what we need to support.
Now, the reason I was asking about that, I was thinking about how far the ducks nest away from the potholes, but, you know, having that area for the water that's draining back into those potholes, it cleans it up a lot. But
you hear
so many horror stories when it concerns these prairie potholes up north of us that, man, they'll disc right up to the water's edge. Well, a pothole's no good without any cover beside it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And those two concerns.
If they have a dry fall, they're going to burn every cattail they can. Because without the cattails, it doesn't hold the snow. Without the snow, it tends to not be a pothole. That's the easiest way for them to dry them out in the first place, is to just get all the cover around it gone. No snow, no more pothole. Pile it, we're done. I've been up there when we're driving around and the whole prairie is smoking up in October hunting. And it breaks your heart, because you know that's probably not going to be a pothole when we come back next year.
Hey, Bill, before we jump back into the story real quick, your story, how bad could this spring be? Hey, we're setting up, and I'm not trying to scare people, but in my opinion, as far as the water and the snow melt, And the water that's present right now in Mississippi, Louisiana, and Arkansas, things don't go just right. It could be tough.
It's bad. Look, the Tennessee River today at our cabin, I watched the Perryville gauge, Perryville, Tennessee. The Tennessee River is going to crest a few inches below at Perryville the record high crest, which was the 1897 flood. So today is the highest the river has been at that point in 1897. And all that's going into the Mississippi River. The Ohio River's flooded. I mean, the White River, all these rivers are blown out. And that's before we get into what you're talking about with the runoff from, it's funny because in January we were all griping there was no snow up north. And I thought, well, at least that's one positive. It won't just blow the Mississippi out and, you know, ruin people's spring. But suddenly all that snow came to the upper Midwest late. And now it has to melt and come. So for people downriver, it could be a tough spring. It really could. I mean, they're opening the Bonnie Carey Spillway.
I saw that.
Today, I believe it's right. We have a lot of people who are going to be out there to talk to the press about it. And that's, you know, that's not really my thing. But they've opened that. What didn't they build? They built it in the 30s. I don't have all the stats in front of me. It's really an impressive. To me, it's one of those places. It's kind of like the SR-71 Blackbird that it still holds like all the records of aircraft. But it was built with slide rule because we didn't have computers when they did that. And this is kind of the same deal where these guys built this thing in the 30s, and it is incredibly well engineered, and it still works. And it's been used, I want to say, 13 times since then, maybe 17, I don't remember the number, but four times, I believe, are in the last 6 or 7 years. What's that tell you?
It can dump how many, a million square feet of water or a million cubic feet of water per second or something? It's unbelievable. That may be totally wrong.
It's crazy. Yeah. I mean, it's, you think people back then weren't all that smart until you see something like that. God almighty, how'd they do that? How did they do that? So, and it's something they don't want to do, but, it certainly is a good pressure valve to take a little bit off of those levees down there. But it's this spring is shaping up to, I don't know when it's going to get better.
Well, that work of locks, or it's not locks, but the gates.
Spillway?
Spillway, that affects you guys' habitat because you're dumping pretty much straight into the Gulf when you open those things, correct?
Well, it's, you know, it opens in the Pontchartrain, really.
Right.
Is what that's doing. But, yeah, it's, you know, obviously taking a whole lot of sediment because when the river's high, you know, the sediment load tends to be high because that's our topsoil from Tennessee washing down to Louisiana, and the same for Mississippi, Arkansas, and all the way up through the Midwest. In a perfect world, that would all spill out all over that delta and help land creation. But, you know, the nature of the beast, we have millions of people living down there, and that, you know, infrastructure and people have to be protected where possible. So, this is one of those deals where you hate it has to be this way, but you just have to do it. Now, hopefully as we move forward and some of these diversions and different things really come online and start effectively creating new habitat, we may find some better ways to spread that water out, but because you hate losing the sediment.
Yeah, you're not kidding. All right, well, Bill, last week we said we were going to jump to the final chapter of the Bill Cooksey story, but
mm-hmm. I hope it's not final of my story.
No.
That sounds ominous.
Well, I wanted to spend some time today talking about those last few days or last bit of time that you were at Avery, and walk us through that, the decision, you know, what led up to that point and what helped make your decision to leave Avery? Because Avery was, man, she was the hot chick at the prom that everybody wanted to dance with.
Absolutely. And it's a place that the company and the people, I spent a long time there and I invested a whole lot of my heart and soul in that company. So it was a very difficult decision to move away from it. And it's weird, and I'm sure a lot of people, you know, who maybe have just worked normal jobs and it was just a job, just a company, never had that personal connection, it'd probably be hard to understand. But ever since I've been gone, I've been interested in what happens with Avery and hoping Avery does well, you know, and so I care about the company. I care about the people who work there. Part of it, I think we got into this a little bit at the time. My wife had an incredibly, she was incredibly successful in her career field, but it also required a whole lot of travel, more so than what I had at Avery, but I still had enough travel I needed to do that it was becoming a hardship. With Bill being home and, you know, you understand the whole kids at home thing and figuring out how to make time work for a couple. And I think everyone gets that. Especially like we didn't have any grandparents nearby, none of that. So that's part of it. You know, as a couple, you have to look at it and say, what's more important? Second, watching the direction of things, not just at Avery, but in the media and marketing world. So much of my background at that point had been tied up in, you know, print and video and some television. And now we're transitioning to social media and, you know, all these, you know, and internet sales. And I'll get into that in a minute.
Hey,
I saw the marketing end changing drastically. And not that that's a bad thing. But like the position I had at Avery, it no longer exists. If you call up and ask for the guy I was, they don't have that person anymore. You know, they have people who do parts of it, but now it's spread out to a lot of folks. So I saw changes coming within the industry that kind of made it appear to be a good time to make a change. And then I had my personal life. And then just watching, you know, it's no secret to people listening that Avery went through some tough times and I'm not trying to say I had anything to, I'm not trying to say this is cause and effect, but it happened shortly after I left. They didn't go through tough times because I left. I want to make that clear, but you could kind of see the writing on the wall because of the way the industry was changing. I mean, you had new companies coming in, you had new ways of selling opening up with internet and social media, and you know, our whole thing. I mean, our business was built around brick and mortar stores and of course catalog. And for years, I mean, our rule, if a guy wanted to order, you know, $5,000 worth of product and he passed credit and said he had a store, that's cool, but we have to have a picture of your store. So, you know, if you couldn't walk in the store, that was against our rules, against our policy. So you can imagine as things evolved, we were having to change a lot really quickly. And, you know, some of these other companies, when we started making decoys, what was out there really? There was G&H, who was kind of the high-end duck decoy. I'm just talking duck decoys. G&H. There was Kerry Light, and Kerry Light was always up and down, and Flambeau. And that was it. Now how many decoy companies are there? And when you get into Goose, it's even bigger. So at one point, these companies didn't have a lot of avenues. We had the shelf space, these new companies. And the same you can say for Bandit, for, you know, all these different companies who have come in the waterfowl accessories side of things. And if you look, a whole lot of the old companies are just about gone. you look around, Hunter Specialties, they're having a hard time even, you know, they have some good people involved at HS now that hopefully are going to get that thing back going in the right direction. Then Final Approach, I don't know what's happening with them. I never see anything about them anymore. So, you know, a lot of companies that were huge are, for the public, almost gone. Fortunately, Avery never quite got into that position. But the industry evolved very rapidly in just a few years, you know, in that 2010, you know, for a couple of years before and after. And I kind of saw where it was heading, and sometimes I say I made a mistake getting out when I did. Other times I say, you know, I'm glad I got out when I did.
Let me ask you this. In relation to when you left to when did – I'm just asking this, and I'm not saying that it's relatable or anything like that, but Tate left and started Drake. Tate was a part of Avery, mm-hmm. but he left and started Drake in what year? 04, 05?
No, that was more like 01.
Oh, wow.
Now, I don't know. I can't say for sure exactly when he started Drake, but he left Avery in, I want to say, 01. Because he wasn't there long after I got to Avery.
And you left Avery in what year? 08?
No, 2011? I'd have to look at my LinkedIn to even know.
I didn't realize it was that long. I thought it was 08, 09, somewhere in there.
Maybe. I don't think so, though, because I'll have to look at LinkedIn to even... I haven't looked at my resume in so long or really thought about it and broken it down in years, and that probably sounds weird, but I just haven't really looked at it that way.
Did the competition, you know, that was kind of the peak of Drake at that point. I would say it is from 08, 09 all the way up to probably 13, 14.
Yeah.
Were there conversations being had in the background? I'm not wanting to get in those conversations, but man, they are putting some pressure on us. But y'all really weren't in the same category in some ways. Some ways you were, some ways you weren't.
Right. Really, it was not a... You, obviously, you keep your eyes on your competition. And Drake was a little bit different because we'd all worked together. Like, Tom and Tate had been very close friends. And the company was named after Tate's father. We've mentioned that. So, obviously, there's a little different aura around that whole dynamic. But... they were so heavy on clothing and outerwear, and we were so heavy on accessories and blinds and decoys. And, you know, Drake made a little push into decoys and all that. And we competed on, you know, decoy line or decoy bags, but they kind of only took, when it came to the stuff we competed on, they mostly took shelf space that we didn't have and weren't trying to get. And we weren't really getting into apparel. So it really wasn't a 2013 is when I left Avery, June of 2013. One of the conversations I remember having about Drake was when we started the Avery Superstore there at our warehouse on Cumberland in Memphis. We started because we didn't have a dealer in Memphis at all. You know, we didn't sell to Bass Pro, and by that time, they were the only thing in town. Buck and Bass, which had been a fixture, was closed. Tommy Bronson's was gone. I mean, everyone was gone. And so we opened that store so we could at least, if people came to our place wanting to see Avery, here you go. And we sat there, Tom and Alan and I, talking about it, and finally decided, let's call Tate and see if Drake will set us up as a dealer. And I was sitting there when Alan made that phone call. Now, I don't know. You know, I know Tate said he would give it some thought, and it was kind of a funny thing because it showed a lot of maturity, because there had been hurt feelings. You're talking people who shared ownership of a company, and that usually doesn't end well. You know, it's like a marriage. If they end, they don't end well normally. But it showed a lot of maturity and character, and the fact that everyone had grown from the initial raw feelings. It never happened as far as Drake putting stuff in the store, but that conversation was had, and it was a positive conversation. When I saw Tate last summer at ICAST, because now Drake's making their fishing stuff, we were talking about Avery, and he said, you know, it's amazing the amount of talent that went through that place over the years. And, of course, they've hired a lot of Avery people over the years when they left. And he said, was Alan really serious? I said, he was dead serious. He said, was Tom good with it? I said, Tom was the one who first suggested we at least consider it. So, you know, that just shows how people change and grow. Fortunately, I don't think Tate and I, our worst times were when we were working together, because we were kind of on opposite sides of a lot of issues when I was trying to get product shipped and he was trying to make the warehouse and manufacturing work when it was all in Coffeyville, Mississippi. So we sometimes would get into it when I wanted something shipped and we can't do that for a few days. You know, so we weren't the best of friends. Once he went to Drake, we could talk anytime, no problem.
All right, you talked about it a little bit. You saw the world changing. You know, you get that feeling in your gut. It's all right. It's time to for me to move on. What really flipped that on switch in your gut to, you know, that it was time?
Well, we were at a crucial time of the year. You know, it was midsummer, and at that point, that was when duck season still wasn't announced until August, and that's when we really started setting up media hunts, that sort of thing. I was trying to figure out how to frame this, because we were trying to grow different aspects of social media and. I looked out into the fall and what we needed to do to promote things, and I didn't feel good or on a solid foundation to do it. And I don't think I can really go deeper with that, but I felt like with the changes within the industry, and that's all encompassing, that's inside Avery, that is inside media, that is other companies and dealers and everything else, I didn't feel like I could continue to successfully push in the same way I had. And we hadn't really figured out an avenue forward. And so I wasn't comfortable, and my family was in a position where I really needed to make a decision. It was almost, it wasn't put to me as your job or your family. But you know when that's really what it comes down to? No one says it, but you know that's really where you are in life. And so I took the family direction.
I've been in those shoes before.
It sucks.
Yeah.
If you like what you're doing.
Yeah. So you left Avery and went. What was your, I guess, choices, decisions, interviews?
Well, you know, when I left Avery, I had several different places contact me about possible regular employment. I interviewed with some different places, but everything came down to big moves. And as we talked about the outdoor industry and be careful what you wish for, and a whole lot of them. And this was one of the things I saw coming. I had successfully gotten to the point where I didn't have to make all the hunting trips. You know, I didn't have to go to every event, every hunt, we had great pro staffers, and they were handling so much of that. now we're getting back to the point I'm going to have to be involved again because of the changes in media. And it's the same with other companies, and either it was too much travel, or I had one who wanted me to move to Michigan, another wanted me to move to Iowa. Well, obviously that's not going to work if I can't even make it work, you know, working in Memphis. So I did some freelance writing. Financially we were in a pretty good position, so it wasn't too big a deal. And I was able to do the things that need to be done at home for a change and take some pressure off my wife and let her do her job. And then I got a call from Carlton Beers at the Mid-South Hunting and Fishing News, and he hired me to be the managing editor of that magazine. Great thing about it, also, it was a great job. It was great fun to do, something I loved and a magazine I cared about. And I got to work from home. And working from home allowed me to, I wrote some copy for Banded. I did some work for Adam Lyerly at Refuge Calls. So I did a lot of consulting type work, did a lot of freelance writing. I wrote for like Bass Times, you know, which is BASS magazine, and several others during that time. And then the National Wildlife Federation thing came up. Which worked out well, because about that time, my wife was having some health issues and really couldn't keep doing what she had been doing. And as I'm sure some listeners know, when you're working for yourself, especially when you're doing a lot of different stuff, it's not like you have a lot of benefits. You just get checks and 1099s in the mail. So suddenly we were staring, are we going to even have health insurance? And we were having to pay COBRA and that sort of thing. And then this came, and I said, wow, this just looks like a cool opportunity. Plus, it took a lot of pressure off with those benefits. I mean, heck, that's during the, you know, Obamacare had just come along, and it was going to kill us on taxes. And that's the best case scenario. That's right. If you don't get sick.
So how did, let's talk Vanishing Paradise for a minute. Mm-hmm. How did that all come about?
A good friend of mine from Bass Pro, I had talked to him. I said, you know, I'm really kind of looking, I'm looking for something permanent, or not permanent necessarily, but a regular job, benefits, et cetera, in the industry. But man, I'm not moving. Or if I'm moving, I'm, you know, it's got to be something really special. And I've told people, that, you know how it is when you're looking around at different jobs. But he called me about 3 weeks later and said, I just saw something for Vanishing Paradise in the National Wildlife Federation. And, you know, I've always been around conservation and always thought it would be a neat place to go, you know, into the conservation world. And I looked up Vanishing Paradise and National Wildlife Federation and realized Steve Bowman from Bass is on the Vanishing Paradise now. It's the sporting council at the time. It was the advisory council, I think is what his group was called. And so I called Steve, and he's like, well, let me find out what exactly they're doing. And next thing I knew, I'm flown to Austin, Texas for an interview, and pretty quick we have this job lined up. And it's been quite challenging, quite interesting, quite eye-opening to what really goes on out there, politically and scientifically. I thought I knew a lot, and now I feel dumber every day.
As you look back over Bill Cooksey's life, give me one story. Because, mm-hmm. you know, we've covered this whole story from beginning to end now for a while. there's one moment that you lay in bed at night and wonder, what if? What if I would have changed this? Everybody has that one regret that bugs them.
Oh, wow.
What's Bill Cooksey's? And as a piece of wisdom to the people that are listening to this, why? Why would you do it differently?
First, I suppose I could come up with a whole list of small regrets. The big ones are tough because you change a big one, it's kind of like the movie It's a Wonderful Life. You think things would be better if you had done X in A Wonderful Life if he had never been born. But in general, you think things... But most of my big changes would have also affected some pretty important things in my world. So, but the one I'll go back to, there again, let's forget that it would have meant I wouldn't have my son, I wouldn't have my wife, I wouldn't have, you know, I wouldn't have had the life I've had. But when I was in school, my father was going every year to Isla Mirada, Florida, to tarpon fish with Jim Rickoff and Gene Hill and all these big media folks from the outdoor world. And so he would go down to tarpon fish, and then it goes Bahamas and bonefish and all this. And he said, son, and my dad knew I was not a studious guy. I got through school, you know. I hated every minute of it. Fortunately, my son's a little better at it than me. But he said, son, I can get you on as an apprentice to one of the top guides in Isla Mirada, Florida. For a couple of years, you're going to wash boats. You're going to clean stuff up. You're going to catch bait. You're going to sometimes go with him and fish and learn about the fishery and where to go. What? And in 3 to 4 years, I'll help you out, and you'll be able to buy a boat, start guiding. And at that time, we're talking back in the 80s, the good ones, it was only a matter of how much they wanted to work. If they wanted to take 2 trips a day, they could do it every day. If they wanted to take night trips in the hottest part of summer, they could take 3 trips a day. And they were making $150,000, some of them $200,000 in the 80s.
Woo! That's a lot of money back then.
Mm-hmm. My first thing was, well, Dad, what about duck season? He said, well, you can take duck season off and go hunt. Well, that just didn't sound... I'm like, stand on a pole, a platform, push pole, and a boat around. And I'd never done it. I'd never gotten to go down there and fish. You know, it was the adult's trip. There were no kids involved. So I'd never gone. And it just sounded awful to me. Not necessarily awful. I mean, look, it's on the water. That's cool. But to be nowhere near ducks... and somehow gear your life around guiding people every day on the water. You're not fishing yourself. What fun is that? And I remember the first time I stepped into a flat skiff, I was about 30 years old. And at that point, you know, I hadn't married Nina yet and we didn't have Bill. I would have given anything to have gone back 10 years and changed that decision.
Let me ask you. Well, that's a major one.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good one. You know, as I told, and mine kind of goes back to, I don't know if you ever listened to the Mossy Island Outfitter story. But when I told mine, and I think all of us have a piece of wisdom where we made a bad choice in life. Yeah, it would have changed the way our life would have went, but we probably should have made a different choice.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
And mine kind of goes back to the early in the stages of my guide service, booming, 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 and I had to lay the choice out to me. You take the business or me, and I didn't have any kids at the time. I didn't care. I'm keeping this business. It is blowing and going. Maybe not the right choice morally. They end up being the best choice.
Yeah.
But Bill, look, you're going to still be on here regularly all the time. I just hate that it's not going to be once a week. It's like I was telling you, pre-recording, you get so comfortable with people, you know you're always going to get an intellectual point of view, an honest, transparent point of view from them personally, and you've been one of those guys. And I think that that's why your numbers, as far as whenever you're on here, are so high.
I appreciate that. I appreciate people listening and enjoying it. It's and I look forward to being on again in the future. I mean, obviously, there's a whole lot to talk about, whether it's duck migrations or clean water or Mississippi River's flooding. And there's plenty of fun stuff to talk about too.
Oh heck yeah, we'll still be talking a lot. Be retired to the Hall of Fame, the End of the Line Podcast Hall of Fame. Not really, you'll be semi-retired, not actually, but we'll put the monument up for you, of course. People walk by and take out their papers.
In lieu of a monument, somebody just helped me find some good turkey ground to hunt this spring.
Woo! You and I need to do that a couple of times. No joke.
But right now, the place I turkey hunt is under about 10 feet of water.
Boy. Well, you need to come up here and go with Troy, and I'll be hunting those first couple of weeks together. They don't have any trips scheduled, so he'll be up here a good bit. And you and Troy being good friends, and we can get together and kill a couple of turkeys and get them on camera.
That'd be a blast. That'd be a blast.
All right, well, Bill, we're about out of time. Thank you again for being here. Thank you so much. I don't usually give people time after saying this, but thank you for taking the time out each week to talk about whatever. We always went into it with a particular direction, and you and I have become such good kind of co-hosts together, friends, that, man, we just talked. May have went a different direction that day.
Oh, yeah. Hey, friends is the best word. I mean, we've developed a relationship through doing these podcasts, and that's gone in a lot of different directions off the air, too. So it's been positive all the way around, and the interaction with people who have listened has been, really great. Had a lot of folks reach out to me, and a lot of folks who have come on board to, helping the cause of conservation. So, all the way around, it's been a great experience, and I look forward to continuing.
All right, Bill. Thank you again. I want to thank all of you that listened to this edition of the End of the Line Podcast, powered by DuckSouth.com.